Now, from the left coast, another in-depth interview from Peter B. Collins. Peter B.'s been talking about news and politics since Watergate and generously shares his knowledge, wisdom, opinions, and outrage here because his friends and family can't take it anymore. Peter B.'s an independent progressive who upsets Democrats and Republicans as conditions require and is one of the few lefty pundits who predicted Trump would win. This podcast is funded entirely by listeners like you, and subscribers get first access to these in-depth interviews. When you're ready, go to peterbcollins.com/signup. Now, here's your humble host, Peter B. Collins.
Thanks for downloading the latest in-depth interview podcast here at peterbcollins.com. It has not escaped my attention that there is a war that broke out near the end of September between Armenia and Azerbaijan. They are fighting over the enclave of Nagorno-Karabakh. And beyond that, I don't know diddly. Frankie Goes to Hollywood opens our podcast today, and when I come up against something I don't know about, my number one rule is that I don't comment on it in my daily news and comment podcast. And the other rule I have is I look for somebody who knows more about it than I do and see what I can learn. So I'm turning today to my friend Terry Phillips. He's a longtime journalist. He covered the region there. He has heritage in Greece and in Armenia. He worked for CBS News for many years. He's also reported for NPR and the old NBC Mutual Broadcast System, which goes back a couple of decades. And he's written about the region. He authored a historical novel called Murder at the Altar that was published back in 2008. And Terry, I thank you for joining us today and schooling me and my listeners in what's going on in Armenia and Azerbaijan.
Peter, it's a great pleasure, as always, to talk with you and to share what knowledge I've acquired over the years, and I'm happy to do that in this case as well.
Well, I appreciate that, and I want you to know, to help me out, I pulled out an actual atlas, the Rand McNally, the edition from 1992 that has a sticker on the outside, Fresh Soviet Changes. And
right.
Part of what's going on is unresolved issues from the breakup of the Soviet Union. Is that accurate?
That's quite true. It actually goes back to the beginning of the Soviet era when lines were redrawn after the collapse of the Russian Empire. And, of course, one can go back millennia, if you wish, to look at ancient history. But in the lifetime of, let's say, our grandparents and great-grandparents, yes, it has mostly to do with unresolved issues during the Soviet era. And in addition to looking at an atlas, I also grabbed the globe from the top shelf.
Mm-hmm.
Out of curiosity, it had been a while since I'd looked at this, and I realized that if you glance at the latitude lines, we in the California, and particularly in Northern California, are on approximately the same parallel as those who are living in this troubled part of the world.
Really, number 38?
Just around 38. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's fascinating. Tell us first of all about the war in the 90s between Armenia and Azerbaijan that claimed some 30,000 lives, and the way the New York Times recently described it, there was a ceasefire but no settlement of that war. And it appears that both sides have been itching to resolve at least the Nagorno-Karabakh question, if not score other vengeful acts in the process.
Right. Some people refer to this as a religious war, which is not accurate. I mean, there are differences of religion between the peoples of those two countries, but it's not about that. It's about territory. and claims of territory that go back, as I mentioned, a long, long time. The people who lived in that area were intermixed. There were Armenians living in Azerbaijan and Azeri people living in Armenia. But as the Soviet Union collapsed, people tended to retreat to their ethnic homelands. And yet there were some remnants of population in those places. Armenia today, the Republic of Armenia, is almost entirely devoid of Azeri people. And similarly in Azerbaijan, most of the Armenians have left there. There were pogroms in Azerbaijan. There were acts of violence against Azeri people in Armenia. It was a really messy period as the Soviet Union was collapsing. And I should mention one other important historical event, which was a terrible earthquake in Armenia in 1988. Mm. And it took tens of thousands of lives and made somewhere in the hundreds of thousands homeless. When Mikhail Gorbachev came to Armenia after that earthquake to express his condolences and to show his support for the people in Armenia, he was shocked that Armenian people were not asking for help for the earthquake survivors. They were asking for help in resolving the issue of Nagorno-Karabakh. Huh. He couldn't believe that that's what they cared most about. But it was the issue and remains the issue for Armenians.
And so, Terry, let me zoom out for a moment, because while this is a kind of a grudge match between Armenia and Azerbaijan, Turkey has entered the fray on the side of Azerbaijan. And Russia has an interest, of course, in maintaining its influence over areas of the former Soviet Union. And then another country that borders the area is Iran, which has regional aspirations. So as we look at the conflict in the micro level, on the macro, the effort to broker a ceasefire has involved Russia, and Turkey has been supplying high-tech drones to Azerbaijan, and together with muscular defense spending by the Azeris, it appears that they have beefed up their capabilities and that they were the aggressor in launching this latest conflict at the end of September. Is that all correct in your view?
I think that's all true. You also have to throw into the mix the fact that Armenia and Turkey have been warring on some level since 1915, when there was a massacre against Armenian people in Turkey. The other issue here that I think needs some attention is the other enclave on the Turkish side of Armenia, which is called Nakhichevan, and which is mostly populated by people from Azerbaijan. And it is also not attached directly by border to the Republic of Azerbaijan, but it is informally and I guess recognized as an autonomous region, whereas Nagorno-Karabakh, the Armenian enclave that is legally within the borders of Azerbaijan, is connected by a roadway to Armenia, but is not does not have any international recognition, even by Armenia. Turkey has been helping Azerbaijan for a long time. Azerbaijan has oil, which it gets, I suppose, mostly from around the Caspian Sea, which it borders. And there is a pipeline that runs near Nagorno-Karabakh, and there's been some concern on the side of both Turkey and Azerbaijan that Armenians could target it. Then there is a nuclear power station in Armenia that Azeri officials have threatened over the years. And that supplies not only most of Armenia's or almost half of Armenia's electrical supply, but they've also sold electricity to Iraq, which, as you mentioned, also is in that part of the world and also has political aspirations.
So this is a little complex. And again, as I'm looking at my Rand McNally here, I see the confluence of these borders. You're not far from northeast Syria. Iraq is close by. Iran has a fairly lengthy border with Azerbaijan, and so this it has to be kind of a real clash of culture, religion, and the deep history. And let me ask you for a moment, because I noticed that you didn't use the word genocide to describe the Ottoman Turks' devastating attack on Armenia, which was, like you said, about 105 years ago. And it's always puzzled me that the secular or allegedly secular government of Turkey in the modern era has been so concerned about being tagged as, of fostering genocide. And they basically argue over the number of Armenians killed and whether, you know, that rises to the level of the term genocide. But the extent to which Turkey has fought to keep the U.S. Congress from adopting toothless resolutions describing the plight of the Armenians as genocide, it's something I've never understood.
Well, there's no question among almost all historians in the world that around the time of the First World War, beginning in 1915, that the Turkish Ottoman government tried to eliminate its entire Armenian population, tried to kill them, tried to drive them away, and succeeded mostly in getting rid of most of the Armenians who were living peacefully in that empire, in that country. It's also true that Armenians were allied with Russians during the war, and Turkey had concerns about, you know, the risk from within. And it's also true that to this day, as you mentioned, the Turkish government refuses to take any responsibility for the crimes of their predecessors. I can't give you an example of another country that willingly admitted such crimes against humanity unless they were militarily forced to do so. But it doesn't change the reality. Every Armenian I know, and for that matter, every Greek I know, because there were similar acts against Greeks in the Ottoman Empire, they all know someone who lost a family member, and in some cases, many, many family members, because of that that act of what most governments acknowledge as genocide. I avoid the term because I think it's more accurate to describe it in journalistic terms. The word genocide is a legal term, and it's one which is still controversial. But if you want to define genocide as the actual or attempted elimination of an entire population, then yes, I suppose it should be called genocide.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it was so long ago that it's hard for me to understand why the current authoritarian president for life, Erdogan in Turkey, right, is so sensitive about it.
Yeah, I think it's very hard once one has made a commitment to a point of view to say, no, I was wrong, it really was a genocide. I don't think that, I think that's probably true of most of us, that if we are committed at our core to a point of view that's almost a religious tenet, that it's really hard to get people to change that. I don't know the way out of that. And, of course, in this current conflict between Armenia and Azerbaijan, since Azeris are Turkic people allied with Turkey, that Armenians understandably see what's happening now as another attempt at genocide, another effort to get rid of all the Armenians in this ancient land, Nagorno-Karabakh, that they consider ours, speaking as an Armenian now, consider ours, that it is has been for, as I said, millennia, populated by Armenian people.
And, Terry, I have to raise the issue of U.S. interference in this region because I would argue that our long-running war and occupation in Iraq will leave Afghanistan out. It's a few miles away from this conflict zone. But I believe that it has led to the rise of Turkey, and that Obama essentially invited Turkey to get involved in the war in Syria, and Turkey kind of established its own agenda related to trying to eviscerate the Kurds. Turkey has now expanded into the war in Libya, and it has played the U.S. off against Russia at times. It's a NATO member. We have sold oodles of high-tech arms, including fighter jets, to Turkey, some of which appear to be used in this current conflict. And there's also tension between Russia and Turkey. But Erdogan has been very adept in establishing, I think, a new regional power center. And Trump has not been interested except in building a hotel in Istanbul.
Yeah, the United States has been sadly noticeably absent from making any effort other than token statements to helping to resolve these tensions. On the contrary, we continue to supply weapons to Turkey, which then turns around and supplies them to Azerbaijan. Israel, by the way, has also supplied some weapons to Azerbaijan, and I'm sure there are other players that I'm unacquainted with who are profiting from this conflict, as is usually the case. And the Russians have been, first of all, the Russians are contractually, or by treaty, I guess is the term, obligated to defend Armenia. They have a mutual defense pact. However, it does not extend, from the Russian point of view, to Nagorno-Karabakh, since, as I mentioned before, the whole world, including Armenia, still treats Nagorno-Karabakh legally as part of Azerbaijan. The international border still surrounds Nagorno-Karabakh.
Hmm.
But at the same time, Russia has been playing a mediating role. I guess it was over the weekend that Sergei Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, invited representatives of Armenia and Azerbaijan to Moscow, and both of their foreign ministers met. They had a very long negotiating effort. I think it lasted for 10 or 11 hours, and they did agree to a ceasefire, a temporary ceasefire, which, of course, was violated hours later.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really hard to see who an honest broker and an effective honest broker might be. At a very human level, both countries now in the last 2 weeks have lost hundreds of fighters and civilians. A lot of damage, especially to, like, speaking from the Armenian perspective, to historical cultural sites. I'm sure that there's similar damage along the Azerbaijan side of the border with Nagorno-Karabakh.
Mm-hmm.
It's an awful, awful war, and I don't see any short-term solution to this, given all the complexities that you and I have been discussing.
And really, in just a little over 2 weeks, we've seen as many as 400 or 500 members of the respective militaries killed, at least 50 civilians. And based on the B-roll that I've seen on the PBS NewsHour, which is the only television network I've seen any coverage so far from, you know, it appears that they are doing a lot of damage to property and even to residential buildings.
The last time I was there in Nagorno-Karabakh, I visited a number of villages, churches, I met with people in their homes, hospitals, and the pictures I've seen also show damage to many of the places I visited. A very good friend of mine, who is a senior correspondent with BBC, Steve Rosenberg, has been in Armenia just in the last few days and has done an excellent job of reporting from there.
Mm-hmm.
They also have a correspondent in Azerbaijan, and they're trying to, as near as I can tell, trying to provide balanced coverage, which, of course, neither side likes because each side wants its point of view told and not the others. But you're right. There's not been a lot of American network television coverage of this. I've seen stories in the major national papers.
Mm-hmm.
But it is largely ignored because it's very far away. It's not very well known. And we have other things going on right now. So
yes,
it's a tough story to get much attention.
So since you've been there, give us a scene setter in Nagorno-Karabakh and what daily life is like for its residents. And are they attitudinally aligned more with Armenia or with Azerbaijan?
Well, the first time I arrived there, there were demonstrators at the airport. It was still the Soviet era. I I hasten to point that out.
Mm-hmm.
There were demonstrators demanding unity with Armenia. They wanted to be reunited with the homeland. I was amazed by what a beautiful place it was, mountainous, lots of farmland, just a lovely, lovely part of the world. Geographically, it takes up about as much territory as, the state of Delaware. So it's not a very big place, but it is the people who live there are passionate about their ties to Armenia. And in fact, I would say that in some ways it goes even in the other direction, that Armenians feel passionately about Nagorno-Karabakh because it is such a beautiful place and has historical significance for Armenian people. The Azerbaijani people, the Azeri people, treat Nagorno-Karabakh, from those I interviewed when I was in Baku and along the border, they treat Nagorno-Karabakh as important to them because it is, from their point of view, theirs. It is legally part of Azerbaijan, and they feel that that land was violently stolen from them. But the daily life in Nagorno-Karabakh, when not in the throes of a major conflict, as is true now, daily life is lovely. It's so peaceful, beautiful is doesn't seem to go far enough, but it's shockingly beautiful.
And Terry, tell us a little bit about the extent to which the conflict that is underway right now is either an extension of the conflict from the 90s or a repeat.
I don't think there is a separation between those two eras. I think that the military people I interviewed when I was there last said that this is the point of survival for Armenia, that they are not willing to cede one inch of land. The closeness of these two countries, the geographical proximity, is such that it wouldn't take much if there were enough firepower put into it for the more powerful side, in this case Azerbaijan, to completely dominate the Armenian side. But it is in some ways, it reminds me in some ways of what's happening in the Middle East between Israel and its neighbors, that these are not just theoretical historical conflicts. These are matters of survival. And that's why battles that I witnessed firsthand seemed to favor the Armenians, because for them it was their homeland that they were fighting to defend.
Mm-hmm.
There's an amazing place in Nagorno-Karabakh. It's a cliff, and it's almost completely vertical. And when at the top of that cliff, when there were Azeri troops occupying Azerbaijan, this is in the 80s, Armenian soldiers climbed almost straight up that mountainside and managed to retake that territory, because the Azeris understandably assumed nobody would try to climb up that hill. It's impossible. It's just straight up. But that was the amount of fervor that drove the Armenians to win that particular battle.
Terry, are there any resources in Nagorno-Karabakh that the parties are fighting over?
It's mostly agricultural land. And in fact, that's true of Armenia, too. I mentioned that they have a nuclear power station in Armenia. But Nagorno-Karabakh doesn't really have much in the way of technology. It is, as I said, mostly agricultural land. Azerbaijan, on the other hand, reminds me a lot of Kern County, where I live at the moment. It's a mix of agricultural land and oil.
Mm-hmm.
And so that has been helping them financially for decades. Of course, now that renewables are taking the place of fossil fuels, part of what I'm sure is concerning Azerbaijan, and by extension their ally Turkey, is that the value of that petroleum has dropped precipitously. 50 or 100 years from now, we might be talking about a very different picture regarding the economy of that region and beyond that region of the Middle East. I don't know how the price of oil will affect these kinds of conflicts, but I presume it will have some impact. And yeah. I think that may be what's involved here, too, is the fact that Azerbaijan's wealth is shriveling with the price of oil dropping.
But isn't there also a huge reserve of natural gas in the Caspian Basin? And isn't Azerbaijan cashing in on that these days?
Sure, sure. And I'm sure there are other mineral resources throughout the Caucasus. But getting to it is not always easy. And, you know, there's a point of diminishing returns, too. I don't know how far they are willing to go, each side. I don't know how far they're willing to go to defend land that is more troublesome than not. Most visitors I met when I was spending a lot of time in Armenia, most people who would come there would say, geez, it's really beautiful here, but is it really worth it? I mean, life's so much better in, you know, pick a place, Glendale or Austin. But there is a passion about this, too. The Armenian Americans I've met who went there for the first time would say to me, I had no idea what a wonderful place it was. And it is, it's historically important, of course, culturally important, but there is that indescribable, difficult to define emotional impact that this all has. And that's, I think, more than anything, what is driving thousands of Armenians in the diaspora all over the world to have to demonstrate in favor of defending their homeland. It's that important to them.
Well, last Saturday there was a fairly impressive demonstration by Armenians on the Golden Gate Bridge up here.
I saw pictures of that, and somebody in Paris just sent me some video of a demonstration in Paris.
Mm-hmm.
It's happening around the globe, and there is a lot of sympathy for Armenians, and I think that might play into this, but I don't know that it will be an important enough factor for any country other than the ones you and I have been discussing to wade into this conflict. There is not an easy military solution to this, and diplomacy seems just beyond reach right now.
And this is kind of coming from left field, admittedly, but I just read before I called you for this interview that the leader in Kyrgyzstan, who's been facing protests first over the parliamentary election, and now it's expanded to include his tenure, he has resigned. Is there any kind of a Caspian Spring that is starting up? That is, you know, can we see any trend lines to that effect?
Well, Armenia kind of already had one. You know, they elected a new prime minister not long ago, and it's the first time in the many years that I've been traveling to that part of the world that I've heard Armenians in large numbers say, we like our government now. So they did have that democracy spring up. I don't know that we'll see that in Azerbaijan, where, much as is the case in Belarus, the dictatorship is so powerful and so good at manipulating its population. But it's not impossible. We've seen dictatorships fall before. I just don't see I'm not close enough to the Azeri side to see the makings of that yet. Would that it would be possible for another peaceful revolution somewhere in the world? Let's talk to our friends in former Czechoslovakia and see how nice it is to be able to pull that off without slaughtering masses of people.
Yeah. Terry, in today's Los Angeles Times, I picked up a story here from Nagorno-Karabakh, and they are describing drones that are being used by Azerbaijan, along with some longer-range artillery, as the military edge that so far Azerbaijan has demonstrated in this conflict. And they take us to the town of Askaran, which is north of Stepanakert. Did I say that right?
Yeah, Stepanakert's the capital of Nagorno-Karabakh.
Okay. And they say that the drones are overflying several times a day. The local population can't see them, but they can hear them. And they're often followed by strikes by fighter jets. What do you know about the military buildup in Azerbaijan, and can Armenia compete?
Well, I can tell you that, again, talking about Turkey, which has been a major supplier of arms to Azerbaijan, that they have dozens of flights bringing in weapons and other supplies, and so they have a pretty good source. The Armenian side is having trouble even getting humanitarian aid because the border between Turkey and Armenia, including the airspace, is closed to travel into Armenia. And the as I mentioned before, there has also been some reporting of Israeli manufactured drones being supplied to Azerbaijan, although I read not long ago that Israel said they would not sell any more. The Armenians seem to have been fairly effective at shooting down Azeri aircraft and destroying Azeri tanks. We don't have a lot of independent confirmation of these reports on either side. And even when I was there, it was often difficult to get that kind of information. We usually tried to give good local reports, but not be able to see the view from 30,000 feet.
Mm-hmm.
It's also, I think, meaningful that Russia has relations with both Armenia and Azerbaijan, and I think that's why they were able to have this, this ceasefire negotiation, for what value it had, but they were able to have this negotiation going on in Moscow last weekend.
Terry, according to the Times here, and they're citing the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, it's about a 4-to-1 edge for Azerbaijan. Since they look at the last 8 or 9 years, Azerbaijan has spent about $19 billion on weapons, and Armenia has spent just under $5 billion. So, you know, I don't know what stockpiles they had before this time frame is cited, but just that snapshot appears to give the advantage to Azerbaijan.
Yeah. There's also been some effort in the U.S. Congress to castigate Azerbaijan, to label it as the aggressor in this case, but I don't know if that would ever be followed up by any direct help from the United States.
Mm-hmm.
European countries have done the same. The United Nations, of course, the U.N. Security Council called for a cessation of hostilities, but words don't seem to make much difference right now, not while the fighting's going on. And the only other player in the region we haven't talked about is the Republic of Georgia. And as near as I can tell, they are uninvolved in this conflict, even though they share borders with both Armenia and Azerbaijan.
Well, and Georgia has some similarities because of the embedded enclaves, if you will, and the support that Moscow has given to some of the entities in the state of Georgia that have challenged the government there.
That's right. And there are some cultural ties between Armenia and Georgia. So if there were going to be sympathies, it would probably be on the Armenian side. But Georgia has its own problems. It's not a big player. It doesn't, as near as I can tell, doesn't have great military resources. And as you say, they've had problems with the Russians, too.
Mm-hmm. So one question I have is, you know, I've seen reports of towns that have been evacuated of 65,000 people. And I'm just wondering about the ability of this region to absorb any additional refugees. I don't know if you saw the documentary that Ai Weiwei produced about 2 years ago, just about the refugee problem worldwide. The 65 million is the estimate. And, of course, Syria has so many people who've been both internally and externally displaced. It's put a lot of pressure on Greece and on the southern European countries. So I just wonder what is going to happen to the people who are caught in this crossfire.
The human toll is definitely very high. The first time I went to Armenia, right after the earthquake, they were dealing with internally displaced people, hundreds of thousands of people who had lost their homes in the earthquake. And just in the last couple of weeks, tens of thousands have fled the capital city, Stepanakert, of Nagorno-Karabakh. So that's, you know, most of the population of the capital is gone.
Mm-hmm.
Where they're going and how they're being housed, I'm not sure. I've read reports about humanitarian organizations, the Red Cross and others, trying to provide shelter and, you know, basic life-sustaining supplies. But it can't go on forever. You know, they were not a rich country before this started. There are some wealthy people there, but mostly this is a poor country.
Mm-hmm.
Azerbaijan is much better off, but even Azerbaijan can't sustain this forever. And won't. There will be some resolution to this. My hope is that cooler heads will negotiate another real ceasefire instead of the one that they came together over last weekend. The long-term solution, some have suggested, will involve an exchange of land. I mentioned at the beginning of our conversation that there's an enclave on the Turkish side of Armenia that belongs to Azerbaijan. It's called Nakhchivan, and it has about the same size, approximately the same number of square miles as Nagorno-Karabakh does. And some have said, well, why don't you just trade, have all the Azeris in Nakhchivan move to Nagorno-Karabakh and have all the Armenians in Karabakh move to Nakhchivan, and that way you all have your countries within the same borders, which is a nice idea in theory, but neither side is willing to do that. They both claim those territories as theirs. In fact, if you go back far enough, of course, the Armenians claim both of those areas as theirs, but that's not a solution either. And so my hope is that there will be some incentive, because the price is so high, and the human price and the actual price in dollars or rubles or whatever they spend, the price is very, very high, and I don't know that they will want to keep doing this, particularly if, here's a leap, but particularly if after our election we finally have some normalcy in the United States and we find a way of looking beyond our internal problems and try to be leaders in the world again. That might be the long-term solution for this. You know, there is an organization, an entity, called the Minsk Group, Minsk, mm-hmm. the capital of Belarus. And I guess it was in the 90s that the United States, France, Russia, Armenia, and Azerbaijan agreed to work out the problems of Nagorno-Karabakh. It was under the OSCE. And they did have a real ceasefire in 1994. It didn't last. There were always skirmishes. It wasn't a permanent, absolute ceasefire. But for most of these past, 25 years, it's been relatively calm along the border between those two former republics. And my hope is, again, that the United States and France and the others, once we can get past our overwhelming domestic problems, can do something to help that part of the world.
Terry, I can't find it here. I got a stack of papers, but the leader of Azerbaijan was quoted in one article I read as basically saying that this is the time for the military option. And I don't know what his calculation is, but he suggested that soon it will be time for political offensives or initiatives. Do you get a sense that this is a short-term effort intended to kind of create pressure for negotiations over Nagorno-Karabakh?
It's possible that they were testing Armenian resolve, that they were pushing much harder than they had in the past couple decades to see what resistance they would meet with, as we've discussed, with help from Turkey largely. And to see if it were possible to overwhelm the Armenians. And I think they've learned that so far it's not possible for them to win by using the amount of the level of military force that they have. It doesn't mean that they won't redouble their efforts, but it could also be a a way of communicating to the Armenian side that they are serious about this. But the Armenians have responded in kind. So he might be correct in suggesting that a military solution is not the long-term solution. But, you know, the price that both sides have paid because of this strategy are certainly not helping Aliyev and his regime.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that he's gotten much sympathy from his own people. And that, frankly, is what led to the last ceasefire, was that there was internal opposition to the level of the cost of the war. When I was in Baku, you know, I saw the coffins coming in, too, and people were very, very dismayed by their own government for failing to... They were neither able to retake the land nor to minimize the cost in deaths and injuries. So I don't know that... I understand his strategy. I don't know that it will serve him well.
Terry, I want to talk about your latest project before we wrap up, but before I go to that, I just want to see if there's anything else you'd like to add about this conflict and its history that I haven't asked you about.
The only other thing I would mention is that these two people, as is often the case in these kinds of inter-ethnic conflicts, these two people, Armenians and Azeris, I find, this is speaking as someone who has Greek and Armenian roots now, they are much more alike than they are different. I think you've heard me say this about Americans and Russians, too, and in the Middle East this is true. And it breaks my heart that they are fighting over things that they ought to be collaborating over. This should be land, as they once did, this should be land that they share. These should be years that they spend building together. But every conversation I've heard, both with Azeris and Armenians over the last decades, has expressed only one point of view, which is we can't live with them anymore. We're done with them. And it breaks my heart. I wish we could find a way of reestablishing some kind of, on a personal level, some kind of connection again, as well as between Armenians and Turks. If I had a magic wand, I would open those borders and you know, throw the armies out and let the people live together again instead of being victims of dictators.
Yeah. Well, this is fascinating, and I learned quite a bit. I appreciate this, Terry. I want to turn next to Imagine Air Theater, and this is a concept that you have rolled out. You're in your second episode. Explain the idea, because it really sings to me, Terry, because I got the radio virus in the fourth grade, and we started doing radio dramas. My speech teacher, Mr. Kane, had worked as a producer at a station called WLW in Cincinnati back in the 1930s, and he taught us how to write and produce and stage live radio drama.
Well, I also caught the acting bug at an early age and took some classes and did some community theater, but didn't pursue it professionally. And then in last year, a mutual friend of ours asked me to write a play. And I have written a few, but not anything serious, and certainly not recently. So I did. I wrote a play, and it was supposed to premiere this year. And, of course, we all know what happened. Theaters are all closed. But not one willing to be stymied by a little thing like a global pandemic, I decided to write plays that didn't require warm bodies inside theaters. And so I started doing what you and I have also done throughout our lives, which is an audio-only version.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've been writing and producing plays where the only stage one needs is the space between the ears, theater of the imagination, and theater of the mind, it's often called.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been very fortunate to have brought together, corralled, maybe is a better word, friends of mine who are professional actors and some not professional, but also who have acting chops, and they've all jumped in enthusiastically. And I would say that in addition to the pragmatic reason for this, I am inspired by the old anthology series on radio and television from the old-time radio years, programs like Suspense from early early television, The Twilight Zone. You know, these are stories that are meant to be provocative, that have a point of view oftentimes. Sometimes they're cautionary tales, as we say, and sometimes they're inspiring. And all of them are meant to be entertaining. They're short plays, so they don't take much time to hear. They usually last, you know, on the order of 10 or 15 minutes. And my hope is that they'll be both entertaining and thought-provoking. And so far, we've had some pretty good success. It's not huge, but we're just getting warmed up. And I hope that Imaginaire Theater will find an audience, or an audience will find Imaginaire Theater, and that we can keep going.
And the easiest place for people to find it is on YouTube, I guess?
Yes, we've also just launched a podcast, so they're both available on, or becoming available on the usual podcast accumulators. I've seen it in a couple of places so far, and I'm sure if you just type in Imaginaire Theater, you'll find it that way. There's a website, too, and it's imagine-air-theater.com.
Okay, I'm going to insert the hyphens here, and I will include a link in the show file of this podcast so people can access it. And I want you to know that episode one really spoke to me. You take us into the Watergate era, and that was where I got my start, doing an all-night talk show in Chicago during the period when Nixon was under investigation, leading up to his near impeachment and resignation. And I haven't accessed your second episode yet, but it's about a talk radio host.
It is, and I think you might find some common ground with that one, too. The third one that we're currently writing, and I say we because I do collaborate with others, and the third one has to do with a man who's in a coma but who can hear everything around him. It's called I'm Not Dead Yet, and I hope that one will come out sometime in the next few weeks.
All right.
We've got a bunch more in the pipeline after that.
Well, Terry, you've always been a creative and resourceful guy, and I'm glad to see you're doing this, and I recommend that our listeners check it out. Terry,
thank you very much, Peter.
Terry Phillips here on the Peter B. Collins Podcast. Thanks for listening to this in-depth interview with reporter Terry Phillips. Send your comments to Peter at peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.